How can we design spaces that make us measurably healthier, happier, and more productive? Join us on Built for Health, where we talk with public health professionals, researchers, and AEC practitioners on the latest knowledge and strategies to design, build, and operate healthier buildings. I'm Flavia Gray. I'm a Schneider Fellow at USGBC, and I'll be your host on Built for Health, brought to you by USGBC. Hello and welcome to Built for Health. I'm your host, Flavia Gray, and in today's episode, we talk about sound and noise with Dr. Matthias Basner from University of Pennsylvania and Chris Pollock from AREP. They will tell us about their respective journeys and how they got involved researching the effects of sound and working in acoustics. What are the effects of being constantly exposed to noisy environments? Some strategies to support improved communication, and the role of building codes and regulatory requirements when designing proper acoustic environments.
My name is Matthias Basner. I'm Associate Professor of Sleep and Chronobiology in Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine.
I'm Chris Pollock. I'm an acoustical consultant and an Associate Principal at AREP. We're a multi-office international design and engineering firm. My specialty is in acoustics and audiovisual systems.
So today we wanted to talk about sound. I think we're always surrounded by sound and noise, but it's something that we sometimes take for granted, and we don't realize how much it can impact our health and well-being and just the way that we work. So why don't we start talking about what happens in building interiors in different types of buildings, and what types of sounds should we be aware of?
Sure. I mean, I think, in our everyday environment, everyone has a different sort of schedule, but a lot of people have a commute where they might be on some kind of transportation. They end up in their workplace or their school, and that building environment, that interior environment, can have a pretty significant impact on their stress levels, their relaxation levels when they try and relax. Certainly in schools, the learning outcomes of a poor environment versus a good environment are quite stark. The fact that the teacher might have a greater difficulty in communicating to students, I think, is something that we've learned a lot about in the last few years. And the LEAD for Schools program represents a best practice where, there's a number of design components that go into making a good classroom, a space for good communication, and a space for, good learning and good cognitive function.
Flavia, I actually, I noticed that you use the word sound instead of noise, and that's actually an important distinction, because noise is actually defined as unwanted sound or something that is disturbing you. So there is both a physical component to noise, but there's also a psychological component to it. And my boilerplate example for this is, somebody who is actually attending a rock concert and is being exposed to like 90 decibels through the music, that's not noise for this subject, because supposedly the subject actually likes the music, otherwise he or she wouldn't have bought the ticket. Although it is very loud or has a very high decibel level, that it's not noise for that person at that point in time. Now, somebody living, three blocks away from the concert hall, trying to read a book at home before going to bed, and still hearing the music from the concert, although it's like, 40 decibels less noisy, or the sound level is 40 decibels lower, it's still noise for that person, because it's interfering with intended activity. So again, there's both the physical component to the noise itself, that is sound pressure level and spectral composition and content of the noise, but then also the psychological component. What am I doing right now? Is the sound something that I actually want to hear? For example, being on vacation and there's a mountain river, generating sounds, and that may be very loud in terms of decibels, but it's not noise to you, because it's pleasant. It's part of the vacation experience at that point in time.
For those people in our audience who might not know what decibels are, could you explain that?
Sound pressure level is measured on a decibel scale, and the range is such a high number scale that we actually use decibels to make that number a little more manageable. So the threshold of hearing is generally in the 0 to 10 decibel range. A quiet conversation might be in the 40 to 50 conversational level. You know, a loud person shouting a few feet from you might be in the 80 to 85 range. A truck going past, you know, at a few feet from you might be in the 90 range, or a jackhammer or something that's kind of ear piercing might be in the 100-110 range, and a jet engine, you know, sort of nearby might be in the 120 to 130 range. And that, you know, that's the sort of range of what most people would experience in any given day. Hopefully most of your day is below the sort of 80 decibel level, because anything that's extended periods of exposure and above that is potentially damaging to your hearing. If you have, you know, if you have a job that puts you in an industrial environment that's above 80 or 85 decibels for long periods of time, that's a level that you might want to use hearing protection for, because there is a potential for damage at that point. But, you know, for most people, you know, their office or their school might be in the 40 to 50 range. And as Matthias said, the potential for an outdoor, serene, quiet environment, it might still be in the 30 to 45 decibel range, but the quality or the content of that sound dictates whether or not that's pleasing for you or not.
That is really interesting to know, because it's, you know, sometimes we just focus on how loud a sound is, and it's really interesting to think about what are the other criteria that we should be paying attention to.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the, I guess, the human evolution of communication, the ears are, our ears and brain are tuned to picking up sounds in our environment that might be cause for alarm or cause for, you know, a flight response. You know, very low frequency sounds like thunder or other sort of natural events are things that are audible to us. But most of our communication is in the range of what we measure frequencies of sound in hertz or cycles per second. You know, a typical voice sound might be in the 250 hertz all the way up to 2000 hertz or 2000 cycles per second. So most of our communication is in that kind of range. So that's the range of the spectrum that we cover a lot in the acoustical design realm.
So Matthias, can you tell us a little bit about what are some of the main problems with noise and how do they affect us?
Yeah, so there's several outcomes that we're looking in the arena of noise effects research. One is simply the fact that people can be annoyed by noise. If for example, if you're living next to a busy road or an airport, and you constantly have to deal with this noise exposure, that leads to noise annoyance, and obviously, you know, generates complaints. You may not be happy with your living environment. You may want to move away, but many people can't afford that. So that is typically one of the measures that policymakers are interested in. That is what part of the population, for example, living close to a railway line, is highly annoyed by that noise source. And of course, you want to try to get that number down as low as possible. So this is one example of a non-auditory health effect. In general, we are differentiating the auditory health effect, and Chris talked about it a little bit. So either if you're exposing your auditory system for a prolonged period of time to noise levels above a certain threshold, and you know, there's still controversy whether that's 75, 80, 85, or even lower than that, your hearing may be permanently damaged. And then there's also the possibility that you're exposing yourself to a very loud sound for a very brief amount of time, and that may be also damaging to your hearing. And then there's the whole area of non-auditory health effect. Again, you know, the community annoyance is one part. Chris already talked a little bit about cognitive performance in children. So if children are, you know, are exposed to noise while in school, there are several studies that show that their academic performance is behind their peers who are in a non-noise exposed area. And there's several reasons why that could be. Obviously, you know, if they, let's say, you know, there's school close to an airport and there's an aircraft flying over the school and it's so loud that you can't really communicate any longer, the teacher really has to stop teaching the pupils at that point and wait until there's a time when they can start communicating again. Of course, there may be miscommunication as well, in the sense that, you know, the pupils may not fully understand what the teacher is communicating. There may also be more effort that the teacher has to put into communicating. And at some point, you know, it may be too much effort and, you know, the communication may actually die down a little bit. So these are the things related to noise and communication. One big thing that I'm personally interested in is noise effects on sleep. We all know that sleep is a very important period during the day. 100 years ago, you know, researchers thought that sleep is a very inactive period, pretty much an anemia of the brain. Nothing is happening. Quite the opposite is true. Sleep is an extremely active mechanism. Hormones are excreted specifically during sleep that are very important for things like memory consolidation. But there's also numerous studies showing that chronically deprived sleep in the long run causes negative health consequences diabetes incidence increases, obesity increases, but also overall morbidity and mortality increases. So obviously noise is a very a potent stressor for waking somebody up during the night. And that in the long run is fragmenting sleep and may cause these negative health consequences related to the sleep fragmentation. And then, of course, there are actually studies showing that long-term noise exposure, in part through that sleep mechanism I just discussed, but also in part just to, you know, general stress reactions that are evoked, may cause negative health consequences, especially cardiovascular disease incidence increase. Directly. So there's multiple epidemiologic studies showing that people who are exposed to traffic noise, for example, of a certain degree for a prolonged period of time, that the incidence of cardiovascular disease is higher in these subjects. And of course, you know, these studies adjust for, you know, lots of confounders. Obviously, sometimes the areas that are noisy are also those areas that are where, you know, the sociodemographics of that area is also not promoting health. So these studies take all that into account, and there's lots of studies. The effects are not huge. It's like we're talking risk increases of like 2 to 3%. Per 10 decibels, but because so many people are exposed to noise, there is a huge public health impact of that noise exposure.
And I believe one of the biggest issues with this, so again, is this lack of awareness. You know, we're always worried about, you know, light, and so everybody carries around glasses in order to protect themselves, for example, when it's too bright. But what do we do about sound? And we're constantly being impacted by it, but we don't really know that it's affecting us. And so it's amazing to learn about how serious it is and why we should be working towards improving our spaces.
We're not only impacted by it, we're also generating it. That's another thing. I mean, yes, there needs to be more awareness, especially about these non-auditory health effects. I think most people know that if you're exposing yourself to too much noise, and that's too loud, that your hearing actually may be affected, but many people are unaware of these non-auditory noise effects. And yes, knowing that that is an issue is important, but there's also things that everybody can do to prevent noise. For example, do you really have to have that, you know, leaf blower that is generating like 90 decibels or something? First of all, you as the user may become deaf yourself because of using it without adequate hearing protection, but then you may also wake up your neighbors in the, you know, on a Saturday morning, and then, you know, they lose an hour of sleep because of that. So it's, yes, knowing about the impacts of noise, but also trying to avoid noise on an individual basis. Of course, there's many things we can't do anything about as an individual person, but there are things that we can address as an individual as well, and that's important too.
Yeah, I think everyone has sort of been to that concert or that loud event where they might experience their ears sort of ringing afterwards, and that ringing sound might be an indication that you've been in an environment where there is actually a physiological impact to your hearing. Some of those impacts are short term and may be recoverable, but that ringing sensation is an indication that you're pushing the envelope, perhaps, and that if that's an environment that you're in regularly, whether it's a train ride or an aircraft or a noisy rock concert, loud rock concert, that might be somewhere that you want to consider hearing protection, earplugs or what have you.
I love that. So we can always start by the individual, but I also love, Matthias, that you brought up there are stuff that we can't do as individuals, and then we have to start thinking about what happens to the environment, which is a great segue into asking Chris about what are your strategies. So when you're thinking about designing a new space where a lot of people are going to be living, working, learning, how do you think about sound and noise? And so what should our listeners do when they're thinking about a new project, for example?
Yeah, I think it's one of the first steps that we often take is really understanding the environment they were in, and that is, you know, is there a specific noise source outdoors that we're trying to keep from projecting indoors. We study the building envelope, and we design the building envelope for a certain performance. That's either a sound transmission class or what we call an OITC rating, an outdoor to indoor transmission class, where the glass and the facade or the exterior of the building has a certain barrier effect to stop sound coming in. And you know, we can take two approaches. One is to understand what the noise level outside is and create a buffer to that by upgrading the glass or upgrading the construction of the building. And the other is to sort of determine what's the ideal interior sound level. You know, if it's a residential project, we might say that we want to aim for 30 decibels or 35 decibels or some number in that range. If it's a hotel or a hospital, there's often best practices, or there might be specific guidelines that the hospital or the healthcare facility has that we want to follow. There are design guidelines called the FGI guidelines that dictate what a patient guest room or patient recovery room or a NICU facility or an ICU facility might have. So we use those as guidelines to try and protect the occupants of the space from exterior noise, whether it's sirens from ambulances, whether it's traffic noise or air traffic noise, aircraft, or just city noise that's common in many of our cities now.
Yeah, and I mean, I can only add to that, of course, that is a very meaningful thing to do. I mean, just trying to attenuate whatever noise is generated on the outside, make sure that it doesn't, is not being transmitted to the inside. And that's also typically something that happens, for example, if you're living close to an airport, if you're living close enough, you'll be eligible for getting sound insulation, so that at least the noise levels that you have to experience on the inside are being lowered, and so that the effects are being reduced at the same time. Of course, the problem is that sometimes we do want to use also the outdoor space of our house, for example, or just want to enjoy nature. And there it is much harder to protect ourselves against noise, because, you know, if you're having a barbecue outside, there is really nothing between you and the noise source. So you kind of just have to live with it and try to adapt as well as possible. So it's much harder to protect ourselves on the outside of a building than on the inside. And, you know, it's a great thing that, you know, things that Chris is doing have come a long way in the past, and that sound insulation is much better. And I believe also much more required nowadays than it used to be, right, Chris?
Yeah, and a lot of cities and a lot of building codes and building departments are realizing that, as urbanization is becoming sort of increasingly popular and increasingly a requirement from an economic standpoint, that decision to live, you know, in town or in a city or in a suburb that might be quite dense does come with noise implications. And a lot of the zoning and sort of planning and zoning departments in cities are taking that into account. Here in New York, there's a designation of certain zones where if you're planning to build a residential building, there's a requirement to maintain a certain interior sound level. So part of the process of getting a building permit and constructing a building includes an assessment of noise and a design of the facade or the envelope of the building to meet a certain noise level. And cities are also understanding that road traffic or street traffic is kind of a given part of the environment, and some cities and municipalities are choosing to combat that using road surface technology. A lot of the noise generated by street traffic, cars and trucks, is actually tire contact noise on the road surface. And, you know, a coarse gravel or a coarse surface can generate quite a significant amount more noise than a smooth asphalt. So a lot of municipalities and departments are understanding that might be a strategy to actually reduce the noise level being generated, which is a good thing for that outdoor noise impact.
And once you have isolated yourself from all of this exterior noise, then we have to deal with all of the interior noise. A question that comes up often for us is, you know, with the biggest trend in workplaces being open offices, how the noise levels have risen and it's become a real problem. So can you talk about what are some of the strategies in this type of environments that you can use to improve this problem?
Yeah, I think that's sort of the practical, the everyday example that a lot of people can relate to. You know, whether it's hearing a person that's sits next to you, or hearing a conversation or an activity, whether it's hearing the hum or buzz from a printer or copier or a coffee machine, whatever that may be, those distracting sounds that can become annoying. If they're repetitive and they're sort of a distraction from your work or from your thought process, they can be quite significant. In terms of design strategies, you know, we work with architects and designers to try and lay out a floor space so that, you know, the noisier events or pieces of equipment are located in a place where they might be sort of tucked away or buffered from most of the occupants of the office. In terms of controlling voices, it's really a matter of providing soft surfaces in the ceiling and walls and sometimes in the furniture, the desks and workstation furniture, to try and absorb that sound and stop the voices from bouncing and reflecting too far from where they are. There's also a technology called sound masking, which some people might know as white noise or pink noise, where we artificially or electronically raise the background sound level in a space so that you don't hear so much of the voice from your neighbor or from people that are in the office with you, but it's still a comfortable level that is tuned so that it's not so bothersome. You can get your work done a little more readily without distraction.
Yeah, actually, while I was at the German Aerospace Center, we worked on that issue a little bit, just looking at an aircraft interior this time. You know, not looking at the effects of aircraft noise on airport residents, but, you know, actually the people are flying on a plane. We all know that this can be very loud, and actually a lot of progress has been made in the more recent past, actually up to a point where the aircraft manufacturers don't want to get it any lower, because what would happen then is that you start you're able to hear conversations when from people sitting in front of you and behind you, and that's something that that is not always wanted either. So, you know, on the aircraft interior side, I guess, you know, they have reached a level which is around 65 decibels. That is not considered being too loud and annoying, but that's loud enough to mask any conversation in your immediate vicinity.
Yeah, I think we've all experienced that kind of interchange at a movie theater or a quiet auditorium where you're aware of those conversations around you. Certainly when the program or the movie has a quiet spot, you can hear people whispering and chatting pretty easily. So a little bit of masking sometimes a good thing.
Yeah, the other thing I was thinking about, and it would be interesting to hear your opinion, Chris, it's probably not that important in an office space, but it could be, is of course that, you know, for a number of years now, we have that technology of noise-canceling headphones, and I really think it's a wonderful invention. In terms of noise-induced hearing loss, we have that problem that over the past 20 years, the reasons for noise-induced hearing loss are more and more exposure to personal music players, for example. People, mm-hmm. you know, it used to be a Walkman, you know, when I grew up, like a cassette player. Nowadays, it's just your iPhone or Android phone or whatever that you use to play back music. And the thing is that you tend to regulate the noise level so that you have, you know, there's enough difference to the background noise level. So the absolute noise exposure will be, you know, dependent on the background noise level. And the great thing of these noise-canceling headphones is that they do exactly that. They lower the background noise level so that you don't have to, you know, push up the volume just as much. So the overall noise exposure of the auditory system will be so much lower. Of course, you know, they work great in an environment that has a constant background noise, like on an aircraft. If you've never used one, please, you know, get a set and try them. You'll be surprised. Of course, you know, in an office environment where you have more talking and everything, they don't work as well. So it would be interesting to hear your opinion, Chris, what you say in that kind of environment about them.
Yeah, I think obviously it's a personal choice that people make, but I think certainly there's a trend that you know, people make that choice in an open office environment if they are focusing on their work and their work doesn't involve, you know, communicating a lot with other people. A lot of people make that choice to sort of use their headphones as a buffer or as a sort of reduction to distraction. But some of the research that we've seen sort of indicates that by adding music to your soundscape or to your environment, your brain is partly, I won't say distracted, but it is performing a function in the background, and you are actually asking your brain to multitask by doing that, even though you might think that music is sort of part of the background and it's not something that's distracting you. It does cause distraction. As for the noise canceling headphones, they work great on aircraft, in trains, or other locations where there's sort of a hum or a buzz or a sound that the constant sound that you want to drown out or cancel out. They do work okay in the sort of buzz of an office environment, but they're not perfect at drowning out or canceling out a specific voice or a specific sound, especially when it fluctuates quite a bit. But it's worth a try. I'd encourage people to give those a try if you're in a space where you're aiming to get a little reprieve from sounds around you.
Yeah, and it's potentially also more like a last resort type of thing. I mean, obviously, the primary goal would always be to optimize the space as is. The same is, you know, when we talk noise control, the most meaningful thing to do is to reduce noise at the source, because noise that's not generated cannot, you know, cause any effects. Sometimes that's hard, though. I mean, with the, for example, with a current day aircraft, they are pretty much optimized any other way. That is, it will be there have been great successes over the past 30 years to get the individual aircraft less noisy, but it's getting harder and harder. What we really would need is a completely new aircraft design that has, for example, the engines on the top of the wings and not on the bottom. And of course, you know, it'll take, you know, if even if we had these aircraft today, it would take like 20 to 30 years for them to really penetrate the market, because an aircraft is flying, you know, for at least 20 to 30 years. So, this it's getting harder to really do the noise control at the source. So there need to be different measures, you know, other ways to reduce the noise. One thing we already talked about is the sound insulation, you know, so that the noise that is generated somewhere else is not transmitted to the inside of the building. There are other things that we, you know, we call active noise control. It's not the active in the sense like what we do with the noise canceling headphones, but it's like, for example, operational measures, you know, trying to find a better flight path that is, you know, flying over a less densely populated area, or new aircraft approaches where the aircraft stays at higher altitudes for a longer period of time, and then there's a steeper descent angle. So trying to maximize the distance between the noise source and the people on the ground. So and these are, of course, measures that could, you know, work immediately. But in the end, it's always, you know, let's try to reduce the noise at the source as much as possible, because everything follows from that. And we can save a lot of money on the you know, noise insulation side, for example, if we only, you know, get to reduce the noise at the source.
Yeah, I think that same strategy holds true with office design. Where, you know, in one scenario, people talking to each other is part of their work and part of their requirement of how they, you know, how they interact with their colleagues at their workplace. On the other hand, that conversation might be bothersome to the people right next door. So one of the strategies that we use with our architectural teammates is really giving people choices and sort of trying to use architecture and layout to instigate a behavioral change, where if you're going to have a conversation, there's a space for that. And that, you know, that might be a breakout space or a huddle room or a little meeting room. And that space is removed from the open workspace, so that when you're having that conversation, you're not interrupting the, you know, the 10 or 30 people that might be directly around you. And the same is true when you're, you know, if you're doing a task that doesn't require, you know, a lot of critical focus, there might be a lounge or a more casual space that it might have a little more activity and a little more noise, and that might be okay for what you're doing. But that sort of strategy of buffering spaces and separating activities so that noisy or active spaces are not directly impacting the quiet sort of focused desk work that people are trying to do, that strategy is changing the way the open office is arranged.
Yeah, another thing we haven't talked about yet is, of course, that, I mean, sounds are a part of everyday life and always have been, I guess. So our auditory system, you know, evolved around sounds. And there's actually the other extreme. There are these silent rooms where, you know, which are dead quiet. And that's something that we as humans also feel uncomfortable in. So, you know, a certain degree of background noise is something that we are used to. So, you know, we don't need to go to extreme and try to get rid of any sound at all. It's really a matter of, you know, reducing to the correct level.
Yeah, some of the research that we've seen shows that even 2 or 3 minutes of I'll say in quotes silence per day can actually give people a little respite, and it can actually cause, you know, a lowering of blood pressure and a sort of relaxation. And the question is, you know, on any given typical day, I mean, how do you integrate 2 or 3 minutes of silence? Where does that happen for you? How do you, like, what space do you go to for that? And what is the sound level? What does that silence mean? Because we, you know, we design spaces that are, you know, dead quiet, that might be sort of 10 or 15 decibels. And a lot of people in that kind of space, you can sort of start to hear your own heart beating and hear your stomach gurgling and all of those other things that you don't normally hear. And that isn't always comfortable for everybody. That might be too quiet. Just removing yourself from the exterior environment of traffic or other people, you know, that might be enough silence to get some restorative, regenerative benefit.
Right. I mean, the interesting thing is that we, as humans, we habituate to a lot of different things, and habituating in the sense that we at some point don't realize, you know, what we're exposing ourselves to. I mean, that's certainly true for my sleep deprivation work. If, you know, you chronically sleep deprive subjects, at some point they don't feel more sleepy. You know, they've just gotten used to feeling miserable, basically, and they don't know how well they could perform and feel if only they would get more sleep. And the same is true for noise. And I, you know, I experienced it myself. We actually had one of our noise conferences in Nara in Japan, and you know, I traveled to, you know, Tokyo just for two nights. And not only is the city extremely, you know, clean for a city that size, but it's also very quiet. And, you know, I didn't even notice it that much when I was there, but I was flying back and I was flying into LA, and, you know, the door of the aircraft opened, and I stepped into that airport, and it was just a wall of sound that was, you know, saying welcome to me. And, you know, at that point, I probably, you know, my background threshold or whatever had adjusted to how it was in Japan. And then just getting, you know, being re-exposed to that environment, just, you know, that difference all of a sudden made me realize, you know, what I'm probably exposing myself to on a daily basis. So.
Yeah, that certainly, that constant noise exposure certainly can lead to, you know, increases in stress and so on, that I think we're just sort of learning that those things are long term are not healthy for people. And I, you know, I certainly realize if I'm trying to have a conversation with someone in a noisy restaurant or a noisy cafe, I certainly feel and recognize that sort of agitated or discomfort, not only cognitively by having to really try and focus and listen, but I think just removing myself and from that environment, you sort of feel a little calm from just not being exposed to that kind of noise and hustle and bustle any longer.
Yeah, it's up to a point where you don't really want to communicate anymore because it is so exhausting. Right. I agree. I mean, I made that experience as well. And, you know, I mean, I'm not seeking out those places any longer where it's, you know, you're basically just staring at each other because you can't communicate. I mean, the food may be good, but it's not only the food.
Right, right.
Because you two have been working so much around these topics, you've become so much aware of how it affects your own lives. And so I think this podcast is just, you know, a great first step into getting more people to think about the environment that they're in, the noise and the sound that surrounds them, and empower them to take action and be more conscious about the sort of spaces that they're living and working in.
I guess one thing that we can do, I mean, you know, we make decisions every day. And, you know, one decision is, you know, where do you move to, you know, and should noise play a more important role in, you know, where you decide to live? Another thing is products that we use and buy every day. You know, some of them may be noisy, some of them may be less noisy. You know, try to pick the less noisy ones. What I never understood, you know, when I first moved over to the United States, I was in a house without central air conditioning, and I was looking for window units, and they are all loud. I mean, some of that may be engineering. You know, if you just put a unit in a window that has a huge compressor and everything, it just makes noise. But I thought, why can't I find a quiet one? Because, you know, I would be willing to pay so much more money to get that quiet window unit, especially in my bedroom, right? I mean, you know, okay, I'm a sleep researcher. I've been studying that for years. I know how bad it is. And, you know, people don't realize it. I mean, you know, you may wake up, but you only wake up for a couple of seconds. You're not regaining consciousness. That is, you're not aware of that sleep disturbance. You wake up the next morning, you may have the feeling that you never woke up at night. But if I look at your physiological signals, you woke up like 50, 40, 60, 70 times, right? Industry is asked as well, why can't you come up with wider designs? I get that, you of course want to be affordable as well. But again, I would have purchased that window unit that is 3 times more expensive just to get the noise level down by 10 decibels or something.
Yeah, and some of those things are regulated by building code or by, other sort of state or federal requirements. But a lot of those things are just personal choices that you can make at the store or wherever you're buying these products from. That quieter products or low noise or low vibration products really could take a big part of the market if they're available and marketed that way.
Yeah, and by creating the demand, then there will be more manufacturers that will be addressing these issues. And so, as a conclusion, and what would be your takeaways for our listeners, how can occupants take action regarding the levels of noise and the sound in their spaces?
I think just being aware of sound levels and how it affects you in your home, in your workplace, your school, wherever you spend time. And not only protecting yourself from the negative benefits, but with hearing protection or limiting your exposure, but also at the other end of the scale, looking for the types of acoustic environment that actually give you regenerative effects, whether it's sitting in a quiet park or taking a walk in the woods. Those positive acoustic experiences can really sort of relieve stress and can sort of be a pathway to relaxation and better performance and healthier life overall from an acoustic standpoint.
Yeah, I think, educational campaigns are so important here that people really know, probably, already starting at the elementary school level, what noise can do to you, both auditory, but also looking at the non-auditory effects. And I think people, noise should just, climb up on the ladder of importance if you're thinking about your environment. That is, if you're really buying a house or an apartment, think about the noise issue. If somebody's talking in the neighboring apartment, can you hear that person? Get information on traffic noise, for example. Oftentimes a realtor will show you a house, at a time when the airport is not operating, for example, right? And then you move in and you say, oh my God, I never knew this. So there's actually some initiatives that, put, for example, the average, noise level as one of the variables that you can see on the sheet that comes with the house. So just to, right, to make people more aware, I think it should, awareness is really, a key point here.
Yeah, opening the windows and poking your head out the window and understanding what's around where you're considering living can give you a lot of awareness as to what's there. And visiting a space, at different times of day, weekends, weekdays, what have you.
Perfect. And so for the people who would want to learn more, what are some resources and where can they go to learn more about sound and noise?
Wow, there's a lot of information online. There's a lot of great textbooks about environmental noise, about architectural acoustics, seeking out white papers through the Acoustical Society of America or through the Institute of Noise Control Engineering. There's a lot of resources out there, and there's a lot of dialogue out there just about best practices that that may not be scientific or studies, but are useful information for people in their daily lives. A lot of local governments have a noise ordinance, in your city or town, and being aware of what that is and how that process, whether it's a complaint process or a recognition of a noise level, understanding how you can sort of impact your environment or impact other things around you from a noise code or noise ordinance standpoint is sometimes useful as well.
Great. So thank you again to both of you. It's been amazing having this conversation, and I think we're all much more enlightened now about what is going on around us.
Yeah, thank you. appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you very much.
It was stimulating to learn from Dr. Matthias Basner from University of Pennsylvania and Chris Pollock from AERP about how sound and noise affect our health and well-being, some strategies for noise isolation and sound masking to improve communication, and the role of building codes in the design of proper acoustic environments. To learn more, check out the sound and acoustics courses on the education platform at usgbc.org, including Commercial Building Science, Understanding Acoustics and Sound Control, and Speech Privacy and Sound Masking in Modern Architecture.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Built for Health by USGBC. Now we want to hear from you. What was your favorite part of today's episode? What are your best practices and strategies? Share with us on Facebook or Twitter at USGBC. To learn more, visit our website at usgbc.org. Thanks for listening.